These were laid before the House in advance of this statement and are now on gov.uk for the public to see. The documents we are publishing today are one of the largest government publications ever laid before this House. This disclosure process has been wide-ranging, costing the Cabinet Office alone over £1 million. As the House knows, this was an official-led process, with judgments made by senior officials, and I am grateful for the careful work they have undertaken right up until today's publication. Whilst the first tranche dealt with Peter Mandelson's appointment, withdrawal and severance, this second tranche responds to the parts of the motion which requested communications and documents concerning his appointment and vetting, as well as messages between Peter Mandelson and ministers, special advisers and civil servants in the months prior to and throughout the duration of his appointment. Mr. Speaker, I recognise that the House will need sufficient time to review today's tranche in full, given the size of the publication. As we have just heard from the Leader of the House, that is why I have secured government time on Wednesday for a subsequent general debate, so that there is an opportunity for members to ask further questions after today's statement. To inform that debate and for clarity and accountability, I draw the House's attention to the methodology set out in the publication today. This explains in detail how the government undertook the disclosure process. I will not repeat that in full here today, Mr. Speaker, but I will make reference to a number of areas that I know the House has expressed an interest in previously. First, on redactions. In line with the motion, over 300 individual documents were referred under a process agreed between the government and the Intelligence and Security Committee. I can confirm that no material has been redacted on the grounds of prejudice to national security or international relations without the committee's approval. For clarity, all redacted material agreed with the ISC is labelled in the bundles today with three asterisks. Outside of this arrangement, this process does not change the important and well-established constitutional principle that national security and international relations judgments are ultimately for the government. I once again express my thanks to the Intelligence and Security Committee for their engagement in this process. Further limited redactions have been made outside of the ISC process in respect of information that relates to junior officials' names, contact details like telephone numbers and email addresses, the personal or commercially sensitive data of third parties not relevant to the motion, and where relevant, legal professional privilege. I would also like to confirm that no reductions have been made to references to Global Counsel, other than to protect the identity of individuals who worked there and are not themselves public figures. Officials have sought to be transparent in the material where the individual is a Global Counsel employee. No redactions have been made to references to Palantir and Anduril outside of the scope of the existing ISC redactions process, and no clear references to current or former UK politicians have been redacted on the basis of their being third parties. I can also confirm to the House that no government minister or special adviser has determined any of the redactions themselves. The redaction process has been overseen by Cabinet Office officials and, where relevant, in agreement with the ISC. The Cabinet Office humble address team has taken advice, in addition to this, from an independent King's Counsel, including reviewing the methodological approach followed by officials and acting on that to inform their work. This has helped ensure that the government is confident that its approach is compliant with the humble address and the government's legal obligations. These additional targeted redactions made outside of the agreed ISC process have been made in line with the Freedom of Information Act, the Ministerial Code, and the resolutions on ministerial accountability passed by both houses in 1997. This is important, Mr. Speaker, because it goes to the question of whether the government has complied fully with the humble address. That question should be answered in the context of the established rules and precedents that relate to humble addresses. If these rules were not relevant, then the humble address would have required extensive additional detail on the face of the motion dealing with these procedural issues. However, I do recognise the level of interest in the House in respect of these non-national security and international relations related redactions. And so, on the recommendation of the Intelligence and Security Committee, I can confirm that the Honourable Member for North Dorset, the Chair of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee, has reviewed our approach to third-party redactions this morning. He has confirmed that we have applied the methodology set out in the document and that in his view, the redactions are sensible, reasonable, and proportionate. I thank the Intelligence and Security Committee for this recommendation and the Honourable Member for the additional reassurance he has provided on this point. Yes. Mr. Speaker, as the House is aware, the Metropolitan Police has also asked the Government to withhold some material in scope of the motion, which they considered could be prejudicial to their ongoing criminal investigation or any subsequent prosecution. This request remains in place, and I'm very grateful again to the Chair of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee, with whom we have also shared this information in order to provide additional accountability of the government's actions. I hope that members appreciate the need not to prejudice the investigation and understand that I will not be able to answer questions about certain documents which have been withheld. No responsible government would wish to undermine a criminal investigation and put at risk the justice that it seeks, and I'm sure the House will share this position. I can, however, Mr. Speaker, confirm that this material does include questions put to Peter Mandelson by the Prime Minister's then Chief of Staff and Peter Mandelson's responses. In addition, a small number of documents have been withheld at the request of the police, which fall broadly into the following categories. Firstly, national security vetting information. Secondly, conflict of interest process material. And thirdly, relevant internal correspondence with Peter Mandelson. Such information will, of course, be published at the conclusion of the investigation or at the point at which it would no longer be prejudicial to the police investigation to do so. Mr. Speaker, the documents published in the first and second tranches contain the entirety of the documents the government has available for disclosure, except those few documents I have just referred to in relation to the Metropolitan Police. Members will no doubt have questions about what might be perceived to be missing messages and meeting notes, which I would like to address in turn. On messages that some might expect to be included, I can confirm that we have conducted multiple rounds of discovery from relevant ministers, special advisers, and officials in line with the motion passed by the House. This has involved requesting searches of email, messaging platforms such as WhatsApp, and other related communication services on both work and personal devices. However, the House should note that some messages may not have been backed up where devices may have been changed, or disappearing messages were turned on for reasonable and permitted reasons, including before the dismissal of Peter Mandelson or the passing of the humble address, myself included. I do recall, Mr. Speaker, having some limited exchanges with Peter Mandelson over WhatsApp, including those I have already discussed in the media. But these conversations did not involve transacting government business and were in line with official guidance on the use of non-corporate communications channels at the time. Mr. Speaker, I also share the view put by the Intelligence and Security Committee to the House that there are lessons for the civil service to learn in respect of better note-keeping, archiving, and the use of appropriate levels of secure IT systems in the future. The government has already committed to a review of the use of non-corporate communications channels, the terms of reference for which we will shortly publish, taking into account the concerns that have been raised in this House and the two tranches of documents we have published in response to the humble address. I will, of course, keep the House updated as we progress that work. Mr. Speaker, I will now turn to the material relating to Peter Mandelson's national security vetting process. I can confirm that the vetting process summary and recommendation that was put by UK security vetting officials to the Foreign Office has been shared with the Intelligence and Security Committee. This was shared for the purpose of agreeing redactions as part of the agreed process so that it can be published when we are in a position to do so. What hasn't been shared is the highly sensitive personal data inputs collected during the interview process. These could, for example, relate to how much money an individual might have in a particular account or who a person may have had a personal relationship with in the past. Mr. Speaker, if those participating in the vetting process cannot trust that the information they feed into that process is confidential, it will harm the integrity of the whole system. Anything less than full candor would be hugely damaging and be profoundly negative for our national security. This would be felt by this and future governments and ultimately by the British people. As such, sharing this data for any person undergoing developed vetting would undermine the very basis of our national security vetting system. Mr. Speaker, this is the 10th update to the House on this matter that I have provided, and with the exception of the small number of documents that are withheld at the request of the police, which we intend to publish when the police are content for us to do so, the government now considers that it has duly discharged the duties set out in the humble address. I will, however, return to the House for the general debate on Wednesday to provide a further opportunity for colleagues to ask questions. And on that basis, Mr. Speaker, I commend the statement to the House.
Yeah. Opposition Secretary of State, Alex Burkhardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister for advance sight of his statement. The story in the Times is to be believed, he may be positioning himself to be the chief successor to the Prime Minister. I also thank him for giving me advance sight of the material that was published today, which I was fortunate enough to see this morning. However, it is very important to put on record that only a very few members of this House were able to see it this morning. It was available at 9:30, and yet it was only published at 2 o'clock. And yet here we are today with honourable members of the House not having had a chance to read it, and yet being expected to ask the right honourable gentleman questions. Now, I know the response will come that we're going to have a general debate on Wednesday. But as honourable members opposite will know, in a general debate, if the minister chooses not to take interventions, there is no scrutiny at all. You know, this is, at worst, obfuscation. This is an attempt to deny scrutiny in a way which is unnecessary. The documents should have been published at 9:30 this morning in advance of this statement. It was on the news. The case of Peter Mandelson's appointment remains of the utmost national importance simply because it touches on national security and on the Prime Minister's honesty, integrity and competence. In the material before us today, I want to make two basic points. The first is about disclosure and the second is about the process by which Peter Mandelson was appointed. On disclosure, although we have a huge number of documents, it is clear that very many are missing. Some have been withheld, some have been lost, and it's clear that some have probably been destroyed. Because of the approach the government is taking, however, it is impossible for honourable members to know which documents fall into which category. We're told that the Metropolitan Police has requested that certain documents be retained, but the government has refused to tell us which documents are being retained. Now, I respect the fact that the Right Honourable Gentleman has told us about three broad categories now. This is progress. We did ask for those categories some time ago. We were told we couldn't have them, but it turns out we can have them. We know that there is no good legal basis for the government not to disclose to this House which documents are being withheld. You know, the government should tell us. Indeed, it would be possible for it to disclose those documents to the ISC, or indeed to certain members of the House on Privy Council terms. Again, this is obfuscation. It is an unnecessary attempt to defer scrutiny or deny it. And the humble address did not allow for the government to redefine the request in this way. If the government wishes to retain documents because the Met Police have asked, it should come back to the House and change the terms of the humble address. It has not done that, and consequently, it risks being in contempt. Some ministers have duly handed over their WhatsApp messages. It's clear that some have not. Are we to believe that there was no WhatsApp exchange at all between the Prime Minister and Peter Mandelson? We know that there were, because it's been reported in the press, and yet those messages, the messages that were reported in the press, do not appear in the release today. It's clear that some messages have gone missing. It is also the case that in all of these documents, the Prime Minister's presence is almost non-existent. Almost non-existent. You know, despite the fact that he was appointing a man to be head of our most senior mission, we have almost nothing in his name. It is as though somehow he appointed Peter Mandelson as ambassador without leaving any documentary trace of that decision at all. It really beggars belief, Mr. Speaker. We take the Secretary of State for DSIT. We are well known to be a friend and ally of Mandelson. He appears to have submitted a nil return on his WhatsApp messages. I hope that the Honourable Gentleman will tell us why. Was it that there were never any messages? This seems unlikely. Was it that those messages have been deleted? The House has a right to know. The House has a right to know in each case whether information has gone missing or whether it has not been handed over. We know that Peter Mandelson has refused to hand over his phone. It's in the document. But we know that he was asked to give over his phone on the 31st of March, sometime after the humble address. He's declined to do so, And this is just simply not acceptable that the government should allow this to pass without some sort of pushback. Yeah. You know, the government has within its power the opportunity to take legal action to recover the exit payment it gave to Peter Mandelson if he is not playing ball with the humble address. There's then the matter of redactions. Acres and acres of white space. Constellation of asterisks. Perhaps all too appropriate for a Labour document, Mr. Speaker. It is clear from the reports in the press that the ISC has had serious concerns about the redaction process. I listened to what the Right Honourable Gentleman said, and I will listen with interest to what members of the committee say in a moment. There are a huge number of redactions under the heading third party. On what grounds have these redactions been made? For example, on page 251 of Volume 3, Mandelson refers to someone who is currently staying with him in government property. This name is redacted. Why has it been redacted? Why can the House not be told who was staying in government property with the ambassador? On the national security vetting material, it seems, once again, that the government is happier to provide the Guardian with more information than it is prepared to provide to Parliament. Preparation of the security document for publication appeared in recess, leaked by someone in government who was familiar with it. And then we've seen that the Guardian has achieved from multiple sources that there were concerns raised by the vetting agency about Peter Mandelson's foreign contacts with a Chinese minister, with Oleg Deripaska, with Tamer Heyman, and so on. Multiple sources, and yet we are being asked to believe that this information was only seen by a tiny handful of people within government. Yeah, someone, somewhere, is not being frank with us. Now, if we had time, Mr. Speaker, and we will have time on Wednesday, we could talk about the concerning information about Chagos here. We could talk about the fact that Peter Mandelson, after he had been appointed, asked whether he could do paid work in Shanghai, on a private basis. We could talk about the fact that Peter Mandelson wrote to the then Foreign Secretary saying, if you were indeed minded to appoint me, I would make sure you never regret it. But the truth is that we must return once again to the process by which Peter Mandelson was appointed. And everything in the documents today show that the Prime Minister did not follow the instructions he was given by the then Cabinet Secretary on the 11th of August 2024. He was told to get security vetting done before the appointment was confirmed, and this the Prime Minister did not do. And he was asked to do that because the Prime Minister had been provided with a due diligence document by the Cabinet Office, which said that Peter Mandelson had an ongoing friendship with Epstein after Epstein had been sent to prison. The fact that Mandelson had been a director of a Russian defence company which had supplied arms to Putin during Putin's invasion of Crimea, and the fact that he had maintained unhealthy business relations in China. And yet, despite this, the Prime Minister did not get the security vetting done before he made the appointment. He went ahead and made it anyway, and then the rest of the system was scrabbling around afterwards to try and make up for this error. But it was his error. It was clear that due diligence was not followed. It is a failure that is visible from space. It is a failure that will define this Prime Minister's premiership. It is a failure that will be written as his political epitaph.
Yeah. Secretary Jones.
Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Gentleman for his questions. I think there were three broad questions, one on access to the documents today, second on what documents are available or not, and the third on the redactions process. In terms of access to the documents, Mr. Speaker, as I said to the House in the urgent question before the recess, I've been very mindful of the fact that given the significant number of documents being published today, that we wanted to create as much time as possible for the House to scrutinise them and to be able to ask the government questions. I agree that had I published these documents 45 minutes before standing up to give a statement for 45 minutes, that would have been insufficient in the circumstances. And I hope that he welcomes the lengths that I and the government have gone to, not just to provide these in advance today to himself, but also the Leader of the Opposition, the chairs of the relevant select committees, and other stakeholders, but also by publishing them at a much earlier time compared to normal before the debate today, and then securing a general debate on Wednesday. In respect of the documents that are available, as I said in my statement, Mr. Speaker, this tranche plus the first tranche of documents represent the entirety of the documents that the government has available for disclosure, except for those that have been made available to the Metropolitan Police. He has invited me to list those documents given to the Metropolitan Police. As I've said from the dispatch box before, Mr. Speaker, I'm acting on the advice of the Metropolitan Police in not being able to do that but I'm pleased that he welcomes the commitment we have secured from them to give a little bit more shape to that today with the categories of documents that are being held. I would remind the Honourable Gentleman, and indeed the House, that we have also shared the documents directly with the Chair of the Public Administration Committee so that there is an additional check and balance within Parliament without being able to share these documents more widely until the Met Police tell us. He also asked me, Mr. Speaker, about notification of the Prime Minister's decision to appoint Peter Mandelson as ambassador. I would refer him to the first tranche and the document from his principal private secretary in No. 10 communicating that decision both to the Foreign Office and to the Palace. And then finally, he asked me about the redactions process, which I think I set out in detail in my statement, Mr. Speaker, which was predominantly with the Intelligence and Security Committee where it relates to national security or international relations. And then second, to non-national security redactions in line with established process and precedent, with the additional check provided this morning, again by the Chair of the Public Administration Committee, in relation to third parties, for which he has confirmed, I understand it, that he's happy with the process the government has followed.
Dame Emily Talbridge, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Can I begin by thanking the Minister for giving me access to the papers at 9:30 this morning? Is it right, though, that amongst the 1,500 pages of documents released today, there is no written evidence of any mitigations being put in place, either to minimise Peter Mandelson's conflicts of interest or, more importantly, to reduce the risk to our national security that vetting had flagged? Due to his close connections with Russian oligarchs, senior Chinese officials, retired Israeli spy masters, and a debt of £1 million to buy shares in a secretive Israeli startup. Can the Chief Secretary please tell us, are we going to see such documents later because the police have got them, or do they just not exist at all?
Can I thank the Honourable Lady for her question? And without inadvertently being able to name specific documents, I'm afraid the best I can say to her today in relation to those potential conflicts of interest is that, as I made clear in my statement, that nature of document has been made relevant from the Metropolitan Police's perspective in terms of their criminal investigation.
Lisa Smart, Liberal Democrat spokesperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I thank the Minister for advance sight of his statement, as well as members of the ISC and the Member for North Dorset for their work on this matter. I want to acknowledge, again, the women and girls who found the courage to come forward about the abuse they endured at the hands of rich and powerful men. As we continue to discuss this, we must remember that those women are owed justice. When Peter Mandelson was appointed, UK security vetting advice was overridden. The then FCDO Permanent Secretary suggested that he was subject to constant pressure, and there's a line in today's files suggesting that senior people had expressed interest that the vetting process goes smoothly. Given the Minister's repeated assurances that there was no pressure from government relating to vetting, what does the Minister think that line refers to? We now know that Cabinet Ministers were privately praising and flattering Mandelson from before his appointment all the way to after his dismissal. Senior Ministers showed a staggering lack of judgment. Could the Chief Secretary explain why so much business relating to one of the most controversial public appointments in recent years appears to have been conducted over WhatsApp? Private, informal, and outside the official record, government by WhatsApp, which the Lib Dems have continually called for an end to, must end, because informal messaging outside official channels creates accountability gaps that should trouble us all. Does the Chief Secretary agree that government by WhatsApp must come to an end? Documents released today display concerning evidence that Peter Mandelson lobbied ministers on behalf of his clients. This would appear to be a serious breach of the code of conduct for the other place. Yet an initial reading of the files seems to suggest that many ministers were pliant and responded warmly to him. Could the minister confirm if any ministers reported their concerns about this seemingly egregious lobbying? The government has outlined its plans for the removal of peerages bill, and at first glance it's a narrow and woefully unambitious bill that completely fails to rise to the moment. Could the minister outline what it will take for the government to make meaningful reforms to the second chamber? Senior cabinet ministers asked Mandelson for advice on a range of issues, despite many of these issues falling outside the scope of his role. Issues of how we run this country stretch far beyond this scandal. The ministerial code, which should strongly inform the conduct of those who hold the highest offices in the land, continues to exist as guidance rather than the law. Ministers who breach it face no legal consequences. The Prime Minister can choose whether or not to act on the findings of independent advisers, and this means accountability is optional, and it's far from clear what consequences follow when rules are broken. Will the government now use this moment to bring forward legislation to enshrine the ministerial code in law?
Secretary Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Lady invites me in her first question to comment on the intent of conversations had between people other than myself. I'm sure the House will understand that all I can do at the dispatch box is refer to the documents disclosed in the bundle, given I was not privy to those conversations. She asked me a number of questions about the use of non-corporate communications channels. The guidance is very clear that non-corporate communications channels can be used, but where government is being transacted, the decision then needs to be recorded on official government channels. Nonetheless, WhatsApp has been used extensively, which has raised a number of questions for the government to consider, which we will do as part of our review of the use of non-corporate communications channels, the terms of reference for which I'll be announcing very shortly. She then asked me about the Peerages Bill, which of course was confirmed in the King's speech recently, which we will be bringing forward in due course. We share the ambition to use this as a piece of legislation to modernise the House of Lords in respect of peerages who have brought the House into disrepute. And she asked me again about putting the ministerial code on a statutory footing. And as we've exchanged a number of times across the dispatch box, I would just point to the fact that the changes this government has already made have proven to be effective, given a number of ministers have had to resign.
Chair of the JCNS, Mark Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think any of these cases that are clearly a real risk to national security should alarm everyone around this House. I think back to some of the questions, Mr. Speaker, you recall that I put to then Prime Minister Johnson about his relationship with Alexander Lebedev, for example. But hearing about the case of Oleg Deripaska with George Osborne and, of course, Peter Mandelson as well, and these other characters, as has been set out, is deeply concerning. The point I want to just land on is about the non-corporate communications channels and the IT systems. And I'm delighted to hear that the government is actually reviewing this. But it is a matter of urgency, because it has become the norm, really, for civil servants and for those in government, previous governments as well, to use likes of WhatsApp as the normal operating system. When will that review be published?
Can I thank my honourable friend for his question? The first part of his question, I think, goes to the point I've made in my statement about the importance that the developed vetting interviews must be allowed to be done in full confidence, because we do need to ensure that when people are joining the government in that DV interview, that they are fully transparent with the government about any relationships they may have with individuals. In relation to the review and non-corporate communications channels, I'm hoping to be able to announce the terms of reference very shortly.
Sir Edward Lee, the Father of the House.
As far as the House of Commons generally is concerned, this whole statement is fairly meaningless, because it's impossible to question on the hundreds of pages on the basis of reading documents for a few minutes. So will the Minister undertake, when he opens this debate, because so many of these general debates, frankly, are damp squibs, will he undertake actually to answer every single question put to him by that time? And I see he's nodding, that's very helpful. In my experience, these scandals are always made much worse, not by the original scandal, but by any sense of covering up. So I'm sure the Minister will want to be completely open. And therefore, listening to the opposition spokesman, it's strange that the Prime Minister seems to have so little involvement in this whole affair. I'm reminded of the wartime film, The Man Who Never Was. Does this sum up this premiership, The Man Who Never Was?
Secretary Jones.
I look forward to engaging with the Right Honourable Gentleman in the general debate on Wednesday, where, I commit to the House to do my best to answer questions that are put to me. In respect of the Prime Minister's communications, I would just point out to the House that Prime Ministers don't sit at computers sending emails from Outlook. They have officials who action their decisions on their behalf, which is what is represented in the disclosure.
Mitchell Musk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It seems that Mr. Mandelson's business interests permeated every aspect of government. This afternoon we are to debate the health bill, of which we'll be debating the federated data platform, of which clearly Palantir, a client of Peter Mandelson, will have a specific interest written hardwired into the bill. And we are expected to vote on that without seeing the full documentation and having time to digest it. So can he set out exactly what the relationship was between Mr. Mandelson and Mr. Thiel, and if that was disclosed in the interview process?
Deborah Jones.
I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, I'm not here at the dispatch box to speak on behalf of Mr. Mandelson, and I was not in the developed vetting interview process, nor have I seen that information. So I'm afraid I can't answer the specific questions the Honourable Lady asks me. What I would, though, do is point her to the relevant comments in my statement, where the government has gone to lengths to ensure that references to Palantir have not been disclosed in the document in line with normal commercial process, given the level of interest in respect of that company here in the House.
Sheriff Packard, Simon Hall.
Mr. Speaker, first may I, through the Chief Secretary, thank all of the officials of the Cabinet Office who dealt with this in a very thorough, professional and, as far as I'm concerned, very courteous way, and for that I am grateful. Casting forward, it's probably perfectly correct that a Prime Minister should be able to make a political appointment to an ambassador's position. But there seem to be two key lessons that need to be learned here, and I wonder if the Chief Secretary could say a word or two on both. The first is that vetting should be, as a matter of course, conducted prior to making public an announcement of appointment. The second is that there does seem to be confusion, and the earlier pages of Volume 1 published today indicate this, as to what weight and status being either a member of the Privy Council, the House of Lords, a former member of the Cabinet, gives to what type of vetting is required. Can you assure the House that that key lesson has been learned and the very clear direction has been given to those who are charged with that important and sensitive job, know precisely how to do it, when to do it, and to make sure that there is a level playing field as far as the applicant is concerned?
Rich Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and can I again thank the Honourable Gentleman for his support as Chair of the Public Administration Committee in providing oversight on behalf of Parliament of the Government's processes. The first question in relation to security clearance being concluded before announcement, he is right. That is something that the Government has learned as part of this process, and that policy has already been changed. The second question he asked me, Mr. Speaker, is represented in this bundle by there being an uncertainty about how existing developed vetting policy applies to those who may be a member of the Privy Council and or a member of the House of Lords, given that ministers are not put through the DV process, because that would be an undemocratic interference of the electorate in a democratic process, which could be overturned by unelected civil servants. The documents show that the government came to the right conclusion that Peter Mandelson should go through DV clearance, even though he was a member of the House of Lords and a Privy Councillor. But the documents do show that there was some uncertainty about that, and I agree with him that we should now strengthen the guidance to make sure that that's clear in the future.
Stella Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The challenge for all of our constituents is that every time this subject comes up, they cannot shake the sense that Peter Mandelson's business interests hang like a grubby layer across decision-making in this government. And I know the Minister will want to challenge that and the concern that his behaviour was a symptom rather than the cause of the problem that we face. When we were last in this chamber discussing this matter, I asked the Minister explicitly about the Adrian Fulford review on the 27th of April, and he assured me that the outcome of the investigation into the vetting process would be completed within 3 to 4 weeks. It is now past his own deadline. He will understand the concern that our constituents may have, that frankly, there may be more to come. Can he reassure me that that review is going to be published and what's going to be in it?
Secretary Jones.
The Honourable Lady is right to pull me up, Mr. Speaker, that review has not yet concluded on the timescale that I had hoped for initially. Adrian Fulford is conducting the review at the moment and knows that we want to be able to report on it very shortly. I can't tell the House what's in it yet because I've not seen it, but as soon as I've received it, I will return to the House.
Luke Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The documents show that in July 2025, Peter Mandelson contacted Number 10 to suggest that the Prime Minister should make time to meet Peter Thiel while he was in London. Peter Mandelson described him as a celebrated techie, and this followed the meeting in February 2025 with Palantir in Washington. So, firstly, can the Minister confirm whether that meeting happened? Secondly, can he confirm that if it is the view of the government, expressed unchallenged by their former ambassador to the US, that a man who described Nazi Carl Schmitt as a major influence on his thinking, and who also said that freedom and democracy are incompatible, is indeed just a celebrated techie? And finally, can he confirm that the government will review all links and contracts between the government, the NHS and police with Palantir following the revelations around Mandelson's Mandelson, Global Council and Palantir.
Secretary Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In relation to the specific question about whether there was a follow-up meeting further to that request, I do not know the answer, so I'm not going to make an assumption one way or another. But if the Honourable Gentleman tables a parliamentary question, I'm sure we'll be able to check and confirm for him. He then asks me about Peter Thiel. I'm not going to take the opportunity to give personal views about Mr. Thiel, but his are on the record. And he thirdly asked me about a review of Palantir contracts, and as I think the Health Secretary has confirmed there is a review currently underway in relation to their contract with the Department for Health.
Joe Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Chief Secretary for his statement. He's talked before about the potential implications for vetting, for due diligence, and today about non-corporate communications. But can I ask about one further area of reforms that I know ministers are keen to improve on, which is our lobbying transparency regime, and ask when the House might expect to hear some progress or thoughts to how we could make that more effective and consider the learnings from this episode.
Secretary Jones.
Can I thank my honourable friend for his question and his excellent work in this area, which the government has learnt a great deal from in terms of his expertise. The House knows, Mr. Speaker, that this area, alongside the other areas in relation to non-corporate communications channels, peerage removal in the House of Lords, as well as lobbying and transparency and the work of the Ethics and Integrity Commission, is a portfolio of work that the government is in the process of reviewing. Now that we have completed the publication of the second tranche of these documents, I know that we'll want to accelerate our work on those subsequent areas of review, and I look forward to coming back to the House with an update in due course.
Paul Hurd.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The Chief Secretary is well known for being courteous and passionate at the dispatch box, and somebody that I'm a fan of. However, he's not known necessarily... This is where it's bad. He's not known necessarily for answering everybody's questions when they ask them. So in relation to the question laid by the Father of the House, asked by the Father of the House, can I ask him whether he will commit to opening the debate on Wednesday and, with the leave of the House, close it so that every member of this House can ask him the questions?
Well, I'm very grateful to the Honourable Gentleman and wouldn't want to displease a fan with inadequate performance from the dispatch box. I can tell the House, Mr. Speaker, that we have considered whether I should open and close the debate on Wednesday, which would be unusual. Instead, what we've decided is that my colleague, the Paymaster General, will open the debate. I will be here for the entirety of the debate, and I will certainly do my best to answer all the questions in closing.
Morgan McSweeney's name copied into so many messages. These disclosures show us the need to return to the role of Labour together. Could the Minister confirm whether any third-party redactions relate to any figures associated with Labour together? Another, its former director, has left his seat in this place. Will the Minister tell us when we can expect to see a full and independent investigation into the activities of Labour together?
I refer the Honourable Lady to my previous answer at the dispatch box in relation to calls for an investigation into Labour Together, which is a privately owned organisation outside of government and public service. In relation to her invitation to name individuals who have been protected in the disclosure by third-party redactions for whom they do not have a direct relationship to the motion in front of us, I'm not at liberty to do that. But as I said in my statement, we have put those redactions in front of the Chair of the Public Administration Committee for additional checks and balances.
Given that the key person in this scandal, Lord Mandelson, refused to hand over his personal WhatsApp messages, how can the government guarantee that Parliament and the public have seen the full truth and the Prime Minister was the Prime Minister misled, or is the Prime Minister and the Chief Secretary accepting partial disclosure?
I would gently remind members from the SNP that I think Nicola Sturgeon was very effective at deleting messages during the COVID inquiry. And it's important that ministers do not do that. And I'm sure the SNP have learnt those lessons as much as everybody else. I've made very clear from my statement the documents that we have available in front of us.
Can I just say I'm not responsible for the answer? It's no use appealing to me. The minister can answer of his own ability. Doesn't need my help.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, but any encouragement, welcome. As I said to the Honourable Gentleman, the documents in relation to his questions are clearly set out in the bundle and they speak for themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's very clear that Peter Mandelson should never have been appointed as our ambassador. And I know that we will all have Epstein's victims in our minds today. It's right that the Prime Minister has called for the removal of peerages from disgraced peers, and conscious of the comments from the member opposite earlier. Can the Chief Secretary confirm that the Peerages Bill that appeared in the King's Speech will actually have teeth and enable us to radically reform the upper chamber?
Sarah Jones.
Can I thank my honourable friend for her question? We are concluding internal drafting on the Peerages Bill, and we'll look to secure time to be able to introduce it in this session. I can assure my honourable friend and the House that we want to bring forward legislation that is effective and meaningful, and that is certainly our intention.
Sir Julian Lewis.
I think the country has a right to know how the Prime Minister reacted at the end of Mandelson's vetting process. So have the Prime Minister's comments on the outcome of the vetting been released? Or are they being withheld? Or are we expected to believe that he made no comments about it at all?
Two things, Mr. Speaker. I've made clear in the statement today that vetting documents have been withheld by the Metropolitan Police, although they have gone through, or some of the documents have gone through, the Intelligence and Security Committee. But I refer the Right Honourable Gentleman to the Prime Minister's words previously. As has been clear, the Foreign Office did not flag this information with the Prime Minister. He was not aware of it until they had been leaked to the Guardian newspaper.
Jessica Till.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Chief Secretary for his statement today, and I'd like to associate myself with his comments about Epstein's victims. They must absolutely be at the forefront of our mind. But a significant amount of material in this tranche was reviewed by the ISC, and so would he be able to tell the House what steps officials took to ensure that any documents relating to national security and our international relations have been shared with the ISC?
Can I thank my honourable friend? As I confirmed in my statement, over 300 individual documents were put before the Intelligence and Security Committee for their consideration of proposals from the government for redaction. There were a small number of redaction hearings towards the end of that process where agreement was sought between the government and the committee, and all redactions currently published in the documents have been done with the full agreement of the committee.
Chance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like many of us here in this chamber today, I've not yet had the time to read the 1,000-plus pages of materials released today. But what this release does do is shine a light of disinfectant on the political culture and how we treat the victims and survivors of heinous abusers of women and girls, and on the scandal of how Mandelson, despite being matey with the convicted child sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, was allowed back into the highest possible office. So does the Minister agree with me that it is essential that this sorry episode in British political history leads to a fundamental change in political culture so that the voices of women and girls who survive abuse at the hands of people like Jeffrey Epstein are always listened to and put front and centre?
Secretary Jones.
I certainly agree with the sentiment of the Honourable Lady's question, Mr. Speaker, and in relation to the time made available to read the documents, I again refer her to the general debate on Wednesday, which she's perfectly able to come to.
Sam Rushwood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Peter Mandelson should never have been appointed. I look forward to the day that we can remove him as a peer. But even now, by not releasing his messages, he makes a mockery of this process. Is there anything that the government can do to compel Peter Mandelson to provide the information that this House seeks?
Sarah Jones.
I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, the government has powers to compel disclosure from government employees and from ministers and special advisers, but does not have powers to compel disclosure from third parties outside of our employment. The Metropolitan Police, however, will of course be conducting its criminal investigation, and I'm sure there'll be disclosure through the court process should a case be put forward by the CPS in due course.
Sir John Whittingdale.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Further to the question of my right and friend, the member for New Forest East, we have seen in the first tranche the box note that was sent from the Prime Minister's private office to the Prime Minister setting out the issues and asking whether or not Peter Mandelson should be appointed. But that piece of paper bears no comment. When I asked the Permanent Secretary of the Cabinet Office about this, she said that she would have expected there to be a record, either of the Prime Minister having written a comment or held a meeting to discuss it. Neither is there apparently any record of. Is the Minister saying that it does not exist? And if it does, does not, why not?
Sorry, Jones.
Mr. Speaker, the communication of the Prime Minister's decision does exist in the first tranche, where the Prime Minister's principal private secretary has drafted a letter communicating the Prime Minister's decision to the relevant stakeholders.
Sir Roberts.
Thank you very much, Tavares. All of us have a significant amount of reading to fully understand how the good friend of a convicted sex offender was rewarded with a top job. But it remains obvious that Epstein's victims simply weren't on the radar of the boys' club in control at number 10. Now, the minister can come to his place again and again and again. But how does he justify that culture that was in power at the time?
I would just gently point out, Mr. Speaker, that number 10 isn't solely occupied by men. There are very senior women who work in the Labour Party and the Labour government as well. But in relation to the sentiment of her question, which I agree with, it is important that we have a diversity of view, of diversity of input into decision-making process, wherever decision-makers are, whether in government or business or elsewhere.
Can the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster confirm that the Prime Minister has not deleted any of the messages he received electronically on any personal or government devices in relation to Peter Mandelson?
All of the Prime Minister's messages have been disclosed in the bundle in the same way as every other minister.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Could I take the Minister back to the answer given to the member for York earlier on? Palantir are a very big and very dangerous, in my view, outfit altogether. The government is developing a close relationship with Palantir, platforming, etc. Could he assure the House that everything to do with Palantir will now be paused until we can get to the heart of the whole matter and how they first became embroiled in government contracts, how they gained them, and what their influence is over this government, particularly via Peter Mandelson?
Mr. Speaker, I'd slightly challenge the assumption that the government is developing a so-called close relationship with Palantir. As far as I'm aware, that's not true. Palantir has been awarded, I think, two or so contracts for government services and continues to bid for services, and it's for departments in line with our procurement policy to decide who they give contracts to. But the Right Honourable Gentleman is right. There are a whole range of issues in line with procurement policy that ministers and officials will need to consider, including the protection of people's personal data, the conduct of companies, and their ability to deliver public services in line with our values.
Lincoln Joss.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Minister for his statement. The media are going to have a frenzy over the tittle-tattle of all this stuff over the next 3 days. But to my mind, the whole Mandelson affair represents a very serious breach of national security. And so can the Minister reassure me and the House that the Foreign Office and the security services are turning over with a fine-tooth comb every minute of Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador to make sure that his actions in that office were in the national interest?
Secretary Jones.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm, as I think I have from the dispatch box before, that officials are conducting that review of documentation, but also making sure that through the review being conducted by Sir Adrian Fulford, we avoid these situations happening in the future, in particular with departments to have the right to not take the recommendation of UK security vetting when appointing people to develop vetting status.
Josh Bubbrin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the 1,500 pages published today, I was staggered to find that the victims and survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's crimes are not referred to in any of the documents dated before Peter Mandelson's appointment. The only reference to Epstein's victims here is an email sent after Mandelson was sacked. Victims and survivors should never be an afterthought, and they clearly were in this case. So how will the government ensure that the trauma of Epstein's victims and survivors is never betrayed again?
Secretary Jones.
I'd firstly just say to the Honourable Member that the disclosure of information from Bloomberg and then subsequently from the United States Department of Justice showed a depth and extent of relationship between Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein that nobody was aware of. Nobody was aware of that until that information became public. That, though, doesn't excuse the point he makes in his question. And he's right, as I have said at the start of every statement from this dispatch box in relation to this issue, that whilst we debate all of these procedural issues about WhatsApp or security vetting or who was given a job on what basis, at the heart of this is the most atrocious crimes unimaginable to all of us from Jeffrey Epstein in relation to many, many young women and girls. And we know that this is not just contained to Jeffrey Epstein, but violence against women and girls is, sadly, a more widespread issue that the government is working hard at trying to tackle in line with our commitment to halve it over the course of this Parliament.
One more.
Speaker, the central figure in this entire saga is someone who enjoyed a cosy relationship with ministers at the heart of this government, and yet he's refused to hand over his mobile phone. And the government, many of whom he had as close friends, seem to have simply accepted that refusal. So does the minister really expect that this House can believe that full transparency has been achieved when Mandelson continues to be able to pick and choose what evidence he allows us to see?
Minister.
I share the Right Honourable Lady's sentiment. The government doesn't have the legal power to require the disclosure of Peter Mandelson's device. As I said in earlier statements, there are other powers available, for example, to the Metropolitan Police and others, should a criminal investigation proceed to a CPS case being put before the courts. And so it may become more clear in the future. But the government has done everything it can to ensure that we've provided full disclosure in compliance with the humble address.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Volume 2, Part 3, page 243. His predecessor states when talking about Labour MPs, every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others? Is that the same experience he's having in every meeting he now has?
Minister?
No.
Jim Shannon, final question.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Can I, Chief Secretary is obviously, and he is very well liked and by myself in this House, and we appreciate his honesty in his answers, if maybe not all the information we're seeking. I very gently would remind the Chief Secretary that for the general public, these continued delays border being viewed as obstructive, and the goal for this government must be to show that no one is beyond scrutiny and accountability, and that any further delay or redaction will not help to reach that goal. So will the Chief Secretary undertake to ensure that these delays end, the materials released, and the general public are assured that we are all accountable for mistakes and lessons have to be and must be learned? Thank you.
I thank the Honourable Gentleman for his question. He knows, because I've said repeatedly at the dispatch box, that I take the role of Parliament very seriously in relation to holding the government to account, and as a former Select Committee Chair, in particular the role of Select Committees, as well as the statements and questions we can undertake on the floor of the House. That's why I have gone to lengths to ensure that the Intelligence and Security Committee, the Public Administration Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee, as the lead committees in relation to this issue, have been given as full and as transparent access to the process and the documents as I've been able to make available, and why I've secured additional time for members to be able to ask further questions on Wednesday.
Final question, Charlie Dewis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In Volume 2, Part 1 of the documents released today, pages 115 to 116, there is an email from Ollie Robbins, dated the 16th of September 2025, in which he writes from another senior civil servant in Downing Street, saying that he has still not yet seen potentially crucial documents in relation to the appointment of Peter Mandelson. Now, that date is important. It is the same day that Chris Wormhold, the former Cabinet Secretary, wrote to the Prime Minister saying that all appropriate processes had been followed in appointing Peter Mandelson. Can those two things be true? Can appropriate processes have been followed if Mr. Robbins himself hadn't seen these potentially crucial documents?
Secretary Jones.
It's an important question, Mr. Speaker, but a question that I'm unable to answer, given I was not privy to those discussions at the time. And maybe if other select committees are able to ask questions in the future, they might put that to the relevant people.
That completes the statement. We'll let the front bench change over.